I'm very happy to be here because I was raised in Cincinnati. We moved here when I was 4 and then moved on up to Toledo when I was 16. So my formative years were spent here, and I lived in 3 communities here, which is, when I name them, you'll realize that I got a good sampling of the population. I first lived in Elmwood Place. In Elmwood Place, this is the Second World War was beginning, and it was a port of entry for people from Appalachia. So I was, as a young kid in a school, mostly with people who were immigrants from Appalachia here. And I developed quite an accent, therefore, which I've lost since then. And then I moved to Hartwell. And Hartwell's a little different. You know, I don't know what these places are like anymore, but it seemed to me it was more, people had more money in Hartwell. Didn't have a lot, but they had more. And then we left Hartwell, and I moved to a place that was just out of this world in terms of money, Glendale. Right? I remember digging plantain out of the yard of Mrs. Proctor, who drove an electric car around town. So I think I've known the classes of Cincinnati as a kid, and I think that had a lot of influence on the way I have seen the world since then. We're here, I guess, to think together some about the idea of community. And one of the things that I might be able to share with you results from the fact that for about 35 years at the university, I've been able to travel around North America mainly, but then later in Europe, looking in local neighborhoods at what people do when they try to make things better. And we have asked in hundreds of neighborhoods the people who reside there, can you tell us what the people who live here have done to make things better? Right? And we've collected over 3,000 stories that are the answer to that question. Incidentally, there are 2 ways of knowing things. And I go back and forth from neighborhoods to the university. In a neighborhood, people know by stories. But in a university, people know by studies. So if you have 3,000 stories, they aren't worth much in a university. But there's a secret to turn these leaden stories into gold. And it is when you get to a university, you take your bag of stories, and you pull off the label that says stories, and you put on another label that says case studies. And so we transmuted stories into case studies. And after we had collected about 3,000 of them, we asked ourselves whether or not we could say anything in general about what people do in local communities when they do something that makes things better. And we say better, when we ask people that, they might tell us better how they did something to help girls, how they did something to improve the local commercial strip, how they did something to bring churches together, how they did something to create a choir. So they were all kinds of betters. And when we looked at the stories so that we could say, what could we share with other people about what you say in common about what makes things better? The thing that struck us as most significant, now there were a lot of significant things, but the thing that struck us as most significant was, what did people use when they made things better? And I think the reason that struck us was that almost all the neighborhoods that we visited and talked to people were neighborhoods that would be called older inner city neighborhoods. And at that time, when we were doing this, which would be in the 80s, everybody who was in a position of influence or concern would talk about those neighborhoods as though they were problem neighborhoods. And when we collected the 3,000 stories, what we realized was that we had gathered the information about problem solving in neighborhoods, that we were learning what was there where everybody else was telling about what wasn't there. Incidentally, the systematic method of telling about what isn't in a neighborhood, do you know what the name of that is? We do them in universities. We get paid a lot for counting up what is wrong. It's called a needs survey. Do you have needs surveys in Cincinnati? You know that, right? They're the quantification of misery. They're a way of identifying deficits. Right? But what we realized was that these stories were telling us what was there, not what wasn't there. And so we said, well, what is it that people are using? Since some people think there's nothing there, there must be something there, they're using something to make things better. And after looking carefully at all these stories, we could see that there were five basic building blocks that people used. Five ingredients. Now, they didn't use them all, but they were in every neighborhood, and every story was about the use of some of these ingredients. So we wrote a book about those five ingredients, that's the one that Damon is telling you about. And we wanted to call the book, because it was a book for folks in neighborhoods. We're feeding back. They knew about their own neighborhood, but we could tell them about all neighborhoods, right? So they could get the strength and assurance that what they had could be used and was there, right? And so we were going to call the book The Ingredients of a Successful Community Cake. Now, when the research director of our Policy Institute found that we were going to issue a publication with that title, she said, I don't think you can do that. And we said, why? And she said, well, because those are words for a kitchen, not words for a university. She said, you're going to have to find some words that people don't understand. Right? So that they will come to the university and learn what they already know. Okay? Which is mostly what we do in universities, right? So this is the book, right? And we settled on a word called assets. We said they weren't ingredients or building blocks. They were assets, five assets. And then we called our group the Asset-Based Community Development Institute, which people have heard all around the world, and not a single person who has heard that has ever understood what it means, which is our completely successful effort, right, to be really academic, right? So the book is called Building Communities from the Inside Out, A Path Toward Finding and Analyzing a Community's Assets, and it's five chapters. We have other publications, which are subsequent stories, or we call them case studies, right, about what people do to be successful in making better neighborhoods. They're all in the back if you want to see them. And I don't know, are there some order forms? That's the advertisement, all right? Now, what I can share with you is what the book would share with you, and that is to remind you of something you know, and that is, what are the five assets that exist in every neighborhood that people use when they make things better? And the way we'd like to show that to you is on a map, which we would call an asset map. So let me see if I can draw it up here for you. And it's a little embarrassing, right, because when I show you this, you're all going to say, well, I knew that. So keep in mind that I'm just reminding you and giving you in a kind of order things that you know. So the first asset that appeared in these stories, the universal asset, it's in every story, was a local resident, at least, or residence. They're the primary asset in community building stories. However, I have to qualify that a bit. It isn't that it is residence, it's an aspect of residence that appear in the stories. And what appears in the stories is the gifts and the capacities and the skills of the local residents. You know this glass. And the children's question, is it half full or is it half empty? And adults know that the answer to that is yes. Right? It is half full, and it is half empty, and it is like every one of us, isn't it? We have our problems, our deficits, and our needs, and we have our capacities and our gifts and our skills. And the stories are all about the gifts, the capacities, and the skills of local people, and never about the deficits, the problems, or the needs. Now, that may seem obvious, but what isn't so obvious is that a lot of leaders in communities really don't seem to understand that. And so when we're in neighborhoods, what we find is that institutional leaders, especially outside the neighborhood, are constantly focusing on the empty half of the glass. So they want to know, how many teenage pregnant girls are there here? Or how many people who use drugs are there here? And the peculiar thing about that is, in the neighborhood, you can't do anything with that. Those deficit counts, those need surveys, are useless for neighborhood community building. I belong to a block club in my neighborhood. Several years ago, I had a heart operation. I had a bypass operation. And after it was over, I was supposed to stay home. I stayed home for about a month, and then I went I went to my block club meeting because it was an easy thing to do. It was held in the house of a neighbor, two doors down. And at the meeting, what was happening, by and large, was we had decided to clear a vacant lot on our block and make it into a tot lot, a place for young children. Right? And so this was a meeting where people were planning how to make the tot lot. So a couple people in the block said that they would clear the lot out. It had broken glass and stone and weeds. They would clear it. A couple other people said that they would plant new grass, dig it up, plant new grass. One person said he worked at a place where he could get concrete to anchor the teeter-totters and the swing we're going to put in. Four people said, we'll organize a bake sale, which we can raise money to get the teeter-totter and the swing. And we sort of going around the circle, right? And they came to me. And I said, and I have a bad heart. And they all looked at me like you're looking at me, right? Why is he saying that? Why is he saying that? Do you know why I said it? Because my heart, bad heart, is tremendously valuable. At Presbyterian St. Luke's Hospital in downtown Chicago, they got $50,000 for my bad heart. There are 72 people in the cardiology department on the 11th floor aching for bad hearts. They would have nothing to do without bad hearts. Right? So deficits are valuable, but worthless in communities, as everybody knew in that room when I said I had a bad heart. As you knew when you wondered, why did I bring it up? So the most important thing that I can remind you of is community building at the local level is about the identification, the mobilization of the gifts and the capacities of local people, and never about a focus on deficits, problems, and needs. Although almost all major institutions want to focus local people on deficits and needs, my university wants people in neighborhoods to focus on needs because we get paid for doing need surveys. So universities are saying, let us come out and count your misery. And then downtown, there are foundations. And they say, we pay for misery counts. Tell us what's wrong. And this is not true in Cincinnati, but in a lot of places, the United Way does this too. United Way wants to know. Tell us about your deficits. And then local governments that give grants say, tell us about your deficits. And the downtown newspapers, my gosh, they don't think there is anything in our neighborhoods but deficits. Because that's all they report about, right? We all know it if we live in the neighborhoods. So did you ever think about this dilemma? All of us were concerned about Cincinnati. That the great intellectual institutions, the great philanthropic institutions, the government, and the mass media are saying over and over again to Pat Tim and her neighborhood, what's important about you and this place is what's wrong. And yet nothing ever happened in a neighborhood focusing on what's wrong. But it was the persistence, the ornery cussedness of local citizens who refused to listen to the leading institutions and said instead, nah, we got gifts here. We got capacity. We're citizens here. I don't mean that legally. We're citizens because they know what a citizen is. A citizen isn't somebody who votes. A citizen creates society, produces community. And where there are no citizens, there are no communities. That's why this word, civil society, you hear a lot. So the productive part of folks is their gifts and their capacities. The second asset that appears in a lot of the stories is groups of people who come together to do things and they're not paid. They're members of a group. And when we wanted to make this map, we went to, at Northwestern, we have a graphics department, as you can imagine, a very high-tech graphics department. We said, what could we do for these groups of people? How can we put them on the map? And we learned the word icon. Oh, we'll get you an icon for these small face-to-face groups of people where the members do the work and they're not paid. And after only a week, they came up with this. Right? And so there are these small face-to-face groups where the members do the work and they're not paid. Now, in the political science department, they have a name for these groups. We needed to name them. And you could say, well, they're clubs, they're groups, they're little organizations. But there is a technical name for them, believe it or not, and they have it in political science. And the name is, they are associations. An association means, an association is a collective word, of course. And if I said to you, I have a flock, you'd say, of birds. And if I said to you, I have an association, if you were a political scientist, you would say, an association is a collection not of people or individuals, but it's a collection of citizens. Now, what do we mean by associations in practice? And now those of you in the back will pay the penalty because you won't be able to see what I'm going to show you. We've worked with a lot of neighborhood groups, helping them identify the associations that local people belong to. And this is sort of a master list we developed of the kinds of groups like this that people belong to in local neighborhoods. And the reason I want to dwell a little bit here and then even more later on associations is because when people would tell us a success story, at the end of the story, we say, how did it get started? And in more than 50% of the cases, they said the initiative got started with a local association. So the reason I want to remind you in more detail of what they are is that if you wanted to know what is the fountainhead, what is the spring from which the river of local neighborhood change comes, most frequently, this is it, the associations. And they come in all kinds, addiction prevention groups, community support groups like Friends of the Library, animal care groups. This is, you'd be amazed how many people are grouped together around animals. I am a member of the Cook County Norwegian Elk Hound Owners Association, right? And this is another thing. We are unique. I want to get into this. Americans associate like nobody in the world. There's just no thing we won't gather together. I was just somebody just sent me in Chicago a notice of the September meeting of the Chicago Turtle Society, right? I mean, the people who are coming together about turtles. So animals, anti-crime groups, block clubs, associations of businesses, associations for raising money for charities, putting on civic events, all kinds of cultural associations, choirs, drama groups, etc. Associations of and about disability, associations of education, of the elderly, environment, family support groups, health, fitness groups, heritage and historically focused groups, hobby and collectors groups, men's groups, mentoring groups, mutual support groups like La Leche League, neighborhood improvement groups, political associations, recreation associations, all our faith-based groups are associations. They have one paid employee, Pastor Lynch, or maybe two, but the members do the work and they're not paid. If he comes on Sunday and the members don't come, there's no church. If the members come and he isn't there, there is a church, right? That's how you distinguish an association. Service clubs, all kinds of social groups, all kinds of social cause and advocacy groups, unions, veterans associations, women's groups, and youth groups. So just to be more precise, this is what we're talking about. This is the associational world, and so putting them on the map, right? Here they are. And they are the primary source for the creation of community initiatives that make things better. The third asset is groups of people who come together in the neighborhood and they are paid, right? And so we went back to the graphics department and we said, could you tell us, give us an icon for them? Groups of people in the neighborhood who come together and they're paid. And they said, well, tell us more. We said, well, they come in three kinds. There are the for-profit ones. There are, appearing in the story, are little businesses, or maybe a warehouse, a lawyer's office. Then there are not-for-profits, may appear a Y or a child care center. And then also appear local government groups of people who are paid, parks, libraries, police stations, schools. So those things appear in the stories. Is there an icon for what they have in common is everybody is paid. And they said, took them 2 months to come up with this one, but it's it. They said, unlike associations, all those organizations are triangles. They said, they're organized like this. Right? And so let's put them back on the map. Three kinds of triangles, although we've decided that the most accurate name is institutions. There are institutions in the neighborhood that appear, right? And so they appear in the stories, those three kinds of institutions, the third asset. The fourth asset is the land, the physical space, appears in the stories, right? My vacant lot is an asset in the neighborhood. It might have looked like an eyesore, but it's also an asset, right? So the land and everything on it and beneath it appears in the story, the physical place. These are the three ways that human beings appear in success stories. They're the three human kinds of assets. And then the physical space. The fifth asset isn't the thing. You can't draw it. And it is that people in the stories are sharing, trading, bartering, exchanging, buying, and selling. So we're going to call that, we say, the fifth asset is the exchange that happens in the neighborhoods. You could also call that the economy, because all of those make up the economy, but people think it's just buying and selling that makes the economy, but it is all of those things that make up the economy. So we never heard a story that wasn't about one of these, two of these, sometimes three, hardly ever four or five. So when we knock on the door and we say to the woman in the 3200 block of Laughlin in the neighborhood of Chicago, can you tell us what people here have done to make things better? She, the particular person I'm thinking of, answered. She said, well, last summer my daughter became a teenager when summer vacation came. She didn't have anything to do and she ran around with the girl next door, and by the end of the summer it was clear to me that she was going down the wrong path. She said, so I got together with the girl, with the mother of the girl next door, and we said, what can we do next summer so they won't go down the wrong path? We thought up several things that the girls could do, but we couldn't supervise all of it. So we knew there were six other mothers on the block who had teenage girls, so we had a potluck, got them together, and they thought it would be good for their daughters to have something to do too. It was a common problem. And so we spent the winter figuring out things to do with those girls the next summer. And we had a lot of things that we could do. And we now had enough of us and enough girls that we couldn't do this out of one of our houses. So we went across the street to Tui Park and asked the park manager if we could have a room there, and he said we could up on the second floor. So we gathered each day there, right? And she said one or two mothers would take responsibility each day. And sometimes we'd do things together as a group. Sometimes we'd invite people in to talk with us or show us things. And a lot of times we'd go out to places to learn things. And she said, you know, what surprised us is it was much better than just keeping the girls from going down the wrong path. She said, because, she said, they learned how to work together in a way they hadn't before. And they did some projects that actually helped our block. And I know at least my daughter learned more that summer than she had learned in school the year before. She said, but the best thing of all that happened was happened to us eight mothers. She said, because, Mr. McKnight, we're a real community now. And we've broken the lines down between us and between teenagers. She says, we're a real community now. Now, if you think about that story, what is it? It's a woman takes the initiative to create an association of eight women who connect to a local park. No grants, no professionals, but a strong community. And that's what our 3,000 stories are about, community building. So the first thing I can tell you is that when people do things that are successful in making things better, They do it with local assets. And the second thing is that the story is always about the connecting of assets. Let me say it again. The connecting of assets. And the third thing that I can tell you is to know the first two things won't change anything, because somebody or group has to be a connector. So in the stories, that's the other thing we're always looking for. Who made the connection, right? And who made the connection initially was, right, Mrs. Smithers on the 3200 block of Lathrop. None of this would have happened without her being a connector. If you went to that neighborhood and you said, who are the professionals here, everybody could tell you. Well, it's Dr. Jones and lawyer Sam and Pastor Lynch and older woman so-and-so. So there's a class of people called leaders, right, who by and large don't appear in the stories. If you say, how did this get started? It starts with people who are connectors. And so we shifted our emphasis away from leadership to connectorship. And there you'll find that the number of people who have connectorship abilities is much greater than the number of people who are normally thought of as having leadership abilities. How many of you sitting here think of yourself, when you think about things in this way, as being people who really do a fair amount of connecting in your life? Would you raise your hand? Now, see, Peter, this is a terribly self-selected group. There are six people didn't raise their hands. So you know, we got the right people here. So the question maybe in terms of community building is, who are the connectors? Where are connectors who haven't been activated to be connectors? How can we connect connectors to connectors? And how can we honor and celebrate connectors, not leaders? One of the things that always irks me, I have to confess, I spent the first half of my life as a neighborhood organizer in Chicago, and latter day went to the university. And it always irked me when a bunch of people in the neighborhood do something, and then when it was done and we were going to have a ceremony about it, right, we invited Mayor Daley down, and he came and stood up there and cut the ribbon. He had nothing to do with it. So what we do is we celebrate leaders who haven't done something and ignore connectors who really made it happen all too often. So one of the things I think that all of us know is that the magnification of connectors, their role, and that process is just the most important single thing if you wanted to transform Cincinnati. But the connector has one other attribute, and that is they're gift-oriented. They're about the gifts and the capacities of people being connected. Now, there are people who are the opposite of gift-oriented people, and they're wonderful people. My doctor is one of these people. If I went to my doctor and I sat down to him and I said, he's a good friend of mine, I said, Quentin, I'd say, listen, let me tell you, I'm just so happily married, and we have these two dogs that are just the joy to us, and we paid off the house, and I'm paid twice as much as I'm worth by the university, and our two boys are doing wonderfully well. What would Quentin say to me? You're wasting my time. Because I'm a deficit man, John. So you understand that there's a whole rank of society. We love them, honor them, and they're worthless for community building. These deficit people. But we bring them in all the time as though they're going to fix us up and we'll have a real community. No, no, no. They may get my heart fixed, But unless I get connected in that neighborhood to my neighbors to produce the future, nothing's changed. So you can't invest in services that will fix enough people that communities will change, because there's no way to fix somebody to be a citizen, to take their capacity, connect it with other people, and move to the production of their good society. Now, how does that happen? It happens naturally, and it happens naturally with associations. And that's what the other thing that I want to remind you about. Associations. Why is it, we wondered, that so much of this community building is centered around associations and their work? And I think we finally figured it out. And it is probably this. How strong could your neighborhood be? There is a measurable, absolute answer to that. It can be as strong as it would be if everybody there contributed all their gifts. And anything that results in that happening is community building. And that happens when gifts are connected. So an association could be understood like this. But the reason they are so central to community building is because the real picture is this. That what associations are the magnifying mechanism, the amplifier of the gifts and the capacities of individuals in the neighborhood. And when those come together, empowerment takes place, creativity is generated, and the sum of the parts is much greater than the individual parts. And that's what associations are, our great magnifier of the gifts of citizens. Who knew this first? Who knew this first was a French count, young 23-year-old French count who came to the United States. And you all know him, Alexis de Tocqueville. And he came to the United States and he took a tour. He missed Columbus, and he missed Cincinnati, but he went to Cleveland, believe it or not, which is a little rural community. He went to Detroit, went to Flint, Michigan, went to Green Bay, right? And he was taking a tour. Incidentally, Tocqueville came to the United States with his buddy, a guy named Beaumont, to study a new North American invention for the French government, for the criminal justice system. He came to study our great American invention that they didn't have in France, the penitentiary. Did you know that? In fact, I have his book, The Report on the Wonderful Penitentiary System in the United States. And I don't want to offend anybody here. Penitentiaries didn't just blossom here. There was a group of people who thought up penitentiaries as a way of dealing with people who are deviant. And they were the Quakers. Do you know the Quakers? The Friends, those good, sweet people. They dreamed up penitentiaries. Did you ever think about the word? It's a religious approach to deviance, a place for people to be penitent. Do you know the rooms in a penitentiary? What are they called? Where else would you find cells? In monasteries, right? Penitentiaries were for four generations also places where silence was required. Nobody could talk with. It wasn't until the turn of the century that they began to allow people to speak to each other in penitentiaries. So I just remind you of that, because good intentions aren't worth a damn. All kinds of harm has been done by people who believe they're helping people. The test is in the people they think they're helping. Because what they may really be doing is creating penitentiaries or dependency. Right? So at any rate, Tocqueville quickly did his study of penitentiaries, and then he took a tour of the United States and took notes. And when he got back to France, he wrote the greatest book about American communities ever been written. Nothing else happens today. Rush back to your library and take out of the library a book called Democracy in America, in which he makes his report on what he sees in the year 1831 as he goes to all these local little places. Then, incidentally, he went back to New York where he started, and he went down to the South with his friend Beaumont because he wanted to see an unbelievable thing to him, that this country would have enslaved people. So he took a special trip. It was a really horrendous trip when you read about how hard it was for him to do this. And he went down along the Ohio River and through Tennessee and to New Orleans and then back up through Mississippi and Georgia and Maryland. Looking at this great crime of peace, slavery. And Beaumont, his collaborator, when he got back to France, he didn't write a book about America the way Tocqueville did. He wrote a book called Marie, which was the story of a life of a woman in slavery in the United States. And that book was sort of like the Uncle Tom's Cabin of France. It was the book that led the nation of France to abjure and turn away from slavery. Right? So at least that good came to France from this. But Tocqueville, in his book, said there is a uniqueness in the United States in particular. Now, he talks about all kinds of things, and I just want to talk about one thing, because what he talked about was associations. And he said, the most significant thing that is different happening locally in the United States is people in these little groups. And he said, there are so many of these little groups, he almost laughs about them. He says, you could go to a local community to have 100 people and they'll have 200 associations. They keep grouping themselves in all kinds of ways, belong to four or five of them, right? Because, he said, they're the principal architects of that community. Now, architect isn't the right word, because he was saying that they do three things, these associations. He said, first, he said, these little groups of people, they come together and they decide what they want to do. They decide what is a problem. And in that, he thought they were very powerful. If he were here today and he knew that there were people who were saying, we need to hire a university to go into a neighborhood and do studies and tell people what their problems are, Tocqueville would say, that could never happen in America. That's un-American. Local citizens come together. They decide what needs to be done. They know much better than somebody from the outside. So we've had this kind of funny aberration develop here of un-American activities, having outsiders come in and tell us what's wrong with us. But he knew better than that. It didn't happen. People came together first, and they decided what needed to be done. The second thing they decided, he said, was even more unusual than the first, certainly from a French perspective. He said they decided how to do what they wanted to do, how to solve the problem, not just what the problem is, but how to solve it. And he said, in France, I don't think we'd ever do that. We might think we knew what a problem was, but we'd always invite an expert in to tell us how to solve it. And he said, Americans don't do that. Six Americans think they know together, with their joint experience and knowledge in dialogue, more than any expert knows. They might need a little expert information, but the creation of new things or solution the problems, they think they know how to do. And the third thing they do, he said, is, having decided what needs to be done and how it is to be done, they then get their neighbors to join them and they do it. And in doing those three things, he said, in their hundreds of associations, that's how Cincinnati was made. Not by professionals, not by institutions, but by citizens in association. And he saw that happening, right? And he said, the center of the new community that is North America is the associations in the local neighborhood. So from his view, he wanted to report back to the French people that it's the blue space where in the United States they're making strong communities. And then this 23-year-old made another incredible statement, such an insight. He said, you know, we say we have a democracy in France because we vote, or some of us vote. He said, but voting is the power to give your power away. And if you're in the minority, you can't even give your power away. If you voted for Kerry, right, in a sense, you're powerless even though you voted. You had the power to vote. But he said, what I now realize is that there is a new kind of democracy in America. The title, Democracy in America. Why is he saying democracy in America? He's trying to make the point that they have a much more powerful democracy than we have in France because we think democracy is people voting. He said, but they have, in association, created a tool not to give power away, but to make power and thereby taking power. And in fact, he said, Americans so treasure their power to produce their future that they consistently elect inept people. This is true. It goes on and on. Why is it that they... Why is it that they consistently pick, he says, third-rate people? And he has two reasons, but the main one, he thinks, is because they don't want anybody who has any talent to ever get in power. Because they want to keep the power with themselves. That's how much he understood our sense of what it means to be a citizen, okay? So he said, this is the center of American communities. And our research said, for purposes of neighborhood change, it still is. Now, I want to remind you another thing about the blue space. Remember, associations are the mobilizers of the gifts of individuals. And that is, there is a name for this blue space in the political science department. It's called civil society. You hear civil society. Well, it's Bluesville is civil society, right? You hear a lot about the words social capital. Social capital is what's generated here in these relationships, right? And I would rather call this citizen space because it's the space where we act out of our concern and care in associations. And I want to remind you that there is a lot of talk about care. We value care. We want our communities to care, to be caring places. But for a couple generations, people of good intention have thought that the way you get care for a community is get more and more institutions providing services for local people. A lot of us, that's what we do. And that's all right, excepting it never produces care. Care is the voluntary commitment from the heart of one person to another. I care for her. I care for him. I will care for my father till the day he dies. That's the most precious of all commitments from the heart. And no institution can manage, produce care at all. They can produce a service, and that's good, but it isn't care. Medicare doesn't care. But it's an institution stolen the word from where care is, and care is in the blue space. How do we know? Because every association is the sign of a group of people who care about each other or care about something. And if I wanted to know in your neighborhood in Cincinnati what people really care about, I wouldn't do a survey and ask them. I'd find out what associations they go to and belong. Because I can tell you what I care about, but if I'm sitting on my duff watching the television, that's useless care. But care, that is a voluntary commitment, care, is what you express through association. And the great tragedy of our communities, I think, in the last half century, is that we have accepted the false premise that systems can produce care. They can produce services. But care is in the domain of associations. The major universities in the United States, about 100 of them, have a common questionnaire they administer to their students so they can compare themselves. And they ask these students, they give them this questionnaire at the beginning of the first year, at the end of the first year, at the end of the second, third, and fourth year. One of the questions at the beginning of the first year is, does this university care about you? And 80% in general of the students say yes. They ask the same question at the end of the first year. And 20% of the people say yes, the students. What happened? I think what happened was that our institutions had misled these young people. They hadn't been around a big one. And the first one they got in, they found out very quickly that institutions don't care. They can serve, but not care. They may have people in them who want to care. And incidentally, working with a lot of human service agencies, I think they are designed to be an intake facility for people who care, to put them in a situation where they're not allowed to care. It's called burnout. It happens all over the place. I know this from being with a lot of those people. So at any rate, when we're thinking about care, if we're confused and we think triangles can produce care, and what we're going to do, let's take our young people, right, and think about the last half century. What has happened to young people, I think, mostly, is this. We've said, well, what they need is to be well served, right? So they ought to have a triangle that'll educate them, because us folks in our community, we don't have anything to do with that. And then we now have another medical institution that will keep them healthy. Because what we do in the community doesn't have anything to do with being healthy. Or what we need to do is have a lot of youth programs, right? And get the kids engaged in sports and youth activity, right? And then we need to have Little League. And then we need to have band, right? And then we need to have midnight basketball. And then we need to have correctional and probation programs of all kinds. And the progress of the 20th century in many of our minds and neighborhoods is the demand and advocacy to get our people surrounded by services. And you know, we started doing this because young people act funny. And do you know what's happened? In spite of all our good efforts to triangularize their whole lives, they're acting funnier still. And did you ever wonder why? Why are they acting funnier still? I think The reason may be that they know because of this experience that we don't care. We will pay for something we lie to them and call care, but it's service. Now, all you people over 50, look at this chart and shudder, because we have a national policy. This is what we have in mind for you. This is what we have in mind for me. I shudder at this, because what you're looking at there, put me in the middle, is the vision for care for me, in which I have a nutritionist, a recreational therapist, a nurse, a doctor, an aide, an animal therapist, right, a walker, and it's called a nursing home. A perfectly served world. Will all of you looking forward to this dream of our society raise your hand? Why don't we? Why are we dedicating every policy we can to the multiplication of triangle life for our vulnerable and marginal people as though we're doing them a favor? Instead of saying, you know who those kids are? They're our kids. And the problem is they're not in our association. They're not with us in our productive roles. We have segregated them. Incidentally, I had a good friend, a great social historian, a guy named Ivan Illich. And Ivan said to me one time, he said, John, in all of history and in every country now existing in the world, American young people are the most excluded of all from relationships with adults. That we have decided, he said, uniquely, out of all historical experience and knowledge, that our goal is to make sure for 18 years that young people will be, number one, surrounded by professionals, and number two, with each other. Not with adults in their associational world, in their productive world. And I don't think our youth problem is going to go anywhere away as long as we say, they're acting funny still. Let's get more youth workers in here. Let's get more counselors. They aren't taught enough. Let's get more teachers. And finally, those kids, they'll straighten up. A miserable, tragic failure is going on in our midst because we don't know what Tocqueville knew. And that is, those children are our children. And when we get them in the civil society, in the circles, so that they begin to have relationships and experiences that has made productive adults in every society since the first days until the 19th century or 20th century. And that is being with adults, doing adult things. Not mentoring them, not counseling them, but joining us in what we do. I was with the mayor of a city recently, and I said, you know, the most important thing you could do, you don't do. You should have two kids from the high school with you every day. Every day. And all of us should. And in our associations, we should ask young people to come. But, and now I got to remind you of why we don't, in part. We don't because we call young people a dirty name. Student. Student means you ain't real, Damon, you're becoming. And when you get real, you can join us. But you're just a student. So in Cincinnati, could you stop having students and start having young people who join the older people in productive life? But you have to change your view. And you'd have to say, Every one of them has a precious gift, four precious gifts. And we're connecting their gifts to our lives. Connecting assets makes strong communities. We get weak communities in part because we have disconnected old people and we have disconnected youth from the mainstream of our society and our associations. Oh, Peter, please. One last thing, then we got to talk this over, I guess. It is this. You know this. A lot of people, I think that associations really aren't too important. And you know, in a way, they're right. Because most of us, if we look closely at our lives, might say that what we are mostly is clients and consumers. Now, a citizen is not a client or a consumer. You can't be a citizen and be a client and a consumer at the same time. They are different things. And there are whole societies that have been developed for the purpose of making everybody a client and a consumer and nobody a citizen. It's their intention. One of them was called Nazi Germany. The other was called Communist Soviet Union. Because what was their map? Their map was a map in which there was no blue space. They had great institutions to provide for clients. And if there were any associations, they were merely vehicles for the institutions. The Boy Scouts became Hitler's youth, or the Young Patriots, right? So the mark, mind you, the mark of a tyranny is the lack of an associational space with citizens expressing their gifts. Now, who know that? Who knew that were the founders of this country who put at the top of our Constitution the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights, which says there are two things more important than anything else, and it's the freedom to express ourselves, to give, to contribute, and to associate, right? Freedom of speech and freedom of association, the most important thing. So they knew what democracy is about. And every time we trade in our care, our creativity, and our power for service, clienthood, and consumer life, we're killing democracy. And that's why we're weak. We're too little citizens, contributors, jointly the producers of our world and our future. In a funny way, at best, we think of ourselves as having lost the power that voting once gave us. But even if we had that power, that's not the basic power for community building. It's the basic power for controlling government, but not for community building. I met some years ago one of the five people who was the inner core of Solidarity, the group in Poland led by Lech Walesa. Remember that overthrew the first overthrow of the communist government, a communist government. And in talking with him about what they did, he said, you know, so many people formed underground solidarity societies all over. So there's underground associations, voluntary, of concern, care, and the growing power, that the very fact that it was there so eroded the power of the military dictatorship at that time that they called us in and they said, what do you want? He said, now the truth of the matter is when they called us in, we didn't know why they were calling us and we didn't realize we had assembled that much power. And when Jaruzelski, the general who was the president, said to us, well, what do you want? He said we were stunned and we didn't know what we wanted. because we never thought about it. We never thought this was going to happen to us. He says that Lech is so smart, and Lech says, we want so much stuff, we'll have to solidify it. Give us a week. So we left, and we put out the word to everybody, and he says, from all the little associations all around, we got 1,000 ideas. He says, we had them all up on the wall, and we knew he'd never go along with that. He said, so we decided that we better ask for, we had 2 standards, better ask for something that would be easy to do for him, and 2, that he wouldn't think would make much difference. So he said, we walked in and we said, we've decided we want 1 thing, and it won't cost you a penny, but what we want everywhere in Poland, beginning tomorrow, is people to have the freedom to associate. That's it. And he said, because we knew that that's the ultimate power in a free society. Because associations represent creativity, the power of combined gifts, and the ability to care. And we knew that he was a dummy. Good at military, but bad at history. And he couldn't see that what we were asking for would bring him down. And it did. So that's why I wanted to bring to you a reminder of who we are and what the center of our power for change is about. And I want to say especially about young people that their recovery to community is our task. And that what we need to have in our mind every time we see a young person is 3 words, because I've seen some wonderfully powerful neighborhoods, and they're powered by 3 words. Every adult looking at a young person says, we need you. Not, we're helping you, we're educating you, we're fixing you, we're correcting you, but we need you. We're so weak. We need your energy. We need your gift. We need your commitment. Come on. We'll stop forcing you to run around with young people. And we'll invite you to be a citizen with the rest of us. So, Peter, the ball, I'm bouncing your way.